Welcome to the Urban Uncovered podcast, where we discuss science and science-based tools for everyday life. I'm Aya Tarabin. I'm a translational neuroscience student and a researcher at University College London. Also want to emphasize that this podcast is my personal goal of bringing zero cost to consumer information to the public. So it's quite separate from my other roles. Now, this very special episode will discuss drug repurposing for glioblastoma, aka brain cancer, and current advances in modes of drug delivery. Now, I'm not no expert myself, so without further ado, to better understand this enigma, I'm being joined by Dr. Ben Newland. Dr. Ben is a lecturer at the University of Cardiff and a pioneer in the field of translational sciences. Dr. Newland has made numerous contributions as a researcher in utilizing nano, micro, and macroscale materials for use in the therapeutic avenue. So yeah, do kindly check out his academic profile and his own website via the links provided in the show notes. Dr. Newland, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being here. I believe the question kind of begs itself. You know, given your background training in materials sciences, how come you decided to dedicate, you know, the application of your research to use in the brain?
You're right. I have a background in material science, so unlike the rest of your guests, I can't profess to be an expert in neuroscience, right? But it was about the time that I started my PhD. It was just before that, actually. My mother got diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and the group that I joined to undertake my PhD, the supervisor on the first day said, basically, you know, these are the polymer materials we've got available, and you can pick which direction you want to take this research in. And so it's an amazing opportunity, really. He just says, you know, we'll work with other people across campus to make it happen. So, you know, straight away I thought, well, I definitely want to work on Parkinson's disease. And so this is really where the marriage of the material science and the polymer chemistry work fitted with what's carried on being my interest in the brain, even though it's not just Parkinson's research anymore, as obviously we're going to find out about. But that's really where it stemmed from.
Oh wow, that's quite a fascinating story. And if you were to, you know, dig a little deeper here, your lab specifically, they've recently have been focusing on brain cancer. So can you tell us a little about what brought you into the direction after Parkinson's? Why did you decide to go into that complex avenue?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so my group still has a project that's working on Parkinson's disease. Mm-hmm. And really, we've been developing small materials for delivering cells and delivering proteins and delivering therapeutic drugs to the brain. And really, the interest in brain cancer stemmed from the lack of decent therapeutics for brain cancer, such as glioblastoma.
Right? I see.
The, you know, patients, you know, just for your audience, it's so unfortunate. It's not so common in terms of cancers, but the prognosis is terrible. Really, you know, 12 months, 14 months survival. And that's despite surgical intervention. So a surgeon will typically remove as much of the brain tumor as possible, then concurrent radiotherapy and a chemotherapeutic called temozolomide. And so, you know, despite our best efforts, we haven't really got much better at treating brain cancers over the last 30 years or so. So I'd really thought that the materials that we developed could be super useful in this aspect, in that if a surgeon is going in and removing brain tissue, that is an ideal opportunity for us to insert one of our materials there, loaded with a chemotherapeutic or other drugs that we're now exploring. And the problem being really is, well, why can't they just take these different medications orally, is that we have a blood-brain barrier. It's great for keeping our brain healthy and stopping things that we may have eaten by accident, you know, destroying our incredibly complex brains and spinal cord and everything. So we have this blood-brain barrier, which means, but on the downside of that is that it's very difficult for many drugs to pass into the brain tissue. Okay, so I think this idea that we're already going in there and this means that we are bypassing the problems of the blood-brain barrier opens up this huge avenue for repurposing existing drugs, maybe breast cancer drugs or any other drug that you want to consider for use in brain cancers. And this is not a new idea, it has been done previously, and one therapeutic has come to market for local, what we call local delivery, so where you deliver locally to the tumor, and that's called Gliadel or Gliadel. And really, you know, no disrespect to those that, you know, formulated that. It's fantastic that it's been tried and things like that. But from a material science perspective, from a drug delivery perspective, it's pretty crude. The drug's released very quickly in a few days. It's out, gone. And these are basically stiff wafers. They're like pills being put around the edge of the resection cavity. And it's a stiff material in a soft brain and leads to all sorts of side effects and problems. So the drug delivery profile isn't great and the material itself isn't great. So I just thought that the research that our group was doing already could be a great advancement on that.
Okay, wow. That was a quick roundup of the most common forms of, you know, treatment to exist and what downfalls do come with them. Now, you know, according to a paper I read in the Journal of Translational Medicine, most common forms of treatment kind of work on targeting the immune cells of a patient. And that's how they target the tumor, if I get that correctly. Now, your mode of, you know, drug delivery, does it use the same mechanism or is it different?
So I think what you're really referring to there is immunotherapy, and it's a really exciting field where we mm-hmm. can basically train our own immune system to fight the cancer. The cancer's got, you know, various mechanisms of avoiding this. So this is one avenue I want to explore. And I've got meetings coming up over the coming months with some researchers in Germany about this. But no, to date, it's just standard chemotherapeutics that work by stopping rapidly dividing cells or interrupting cell division. And so thereby not affecting your neurons in your brain, which are not dividing, and therefore attacking the tumor cells, or actually there are also a subgroup of cells called the tumor or the glioblastoma stem cells. Okay, so these are also a population of cells that we really need to get rid of in the brain. So it's not that I'm only interested in using chemotherapeutics, but that's what we've started with so far. We thought that, you know, it's already a sort of, you know, branching into a new field. You want to be taking something that we know works, that's potent in a dish, and try and take that forward, basically, is the idea. But that's not to say I wouldn't be interested in immunotherapies, as I've tried to explain that I'm really keen to explore that route. Yeah.
All right, that's lovely. So there's plenty of opportunities for you to be working on that in the future, I guess. And please do correct me if I'm wrong, but so what you're currently focusing on is really investigating various delivery materials and optimizing the formulations for drug delivery, as I suppose. And your work has mainly focused on using highly porous hydrogel scaffolds. I believe they're termed as cryogels. I'm no expert, obviously, so would you be able to please explain what are cryogel scaffolds exactly?
Yeah, great. No, I mean, yeah, these form the mainstay of our lab. If I'm honest, they're our mm-hmm. bread and butter, and it's where I'm trying to place a lot of our expertise. So what are they? So these are the materials that we're using to deliver, that we originally developed to deliver cells to the brain for the Parkinson's disease project. Then we sort of noticed that, and we modified them so that they'd be good at delivering proteins to the brain, things like growth factors, which support neuron survival, okay, all in the Parkinson's field. And then we realized that the same concepts that apply for that apply for drug delivery too. So that's where that came into. What are they? The easiest way to think of them is like a sponge, okay? So they're like little sponges, and we make them in, as you alluded to in your introduction, we make them in different sizes. Some of them are macro scale. They could be 2 or 3 millimeter in diameter, and they can be like a little cylinder of the sponge, and all the way down to the smallest ones we make at the moment are 20 micrometers in diameter. So very, very small spheres, basically balls of sponge. And happy to elaborate more if on the amazing properties that these give, if you'd like, or if you've got other questions for me. I'm really happy to talk about these cryogels all day if you've got a bit more time.
And I'm just curious, would you be able to please elaborate more on their characteristics and what makes them stand out from other current modes of delivery?
Yeah, so great. There we go. That's what I was hoping for with the question, because I think that was fantastic. The reason they're so interesting is that the properties of them are from the macro scale. If you imagine picking up a sponge and squishing it between your hands, right? It feels very soft. Yet the network that's building that I wouldn't say it's stiff. It's definitely not stiff, but it's very robust. Okay, so the easiest way I can try and describe why that's important is obviously because our brains are very soft. Okay, so obviously, maybe that's not obvious to everyone that hasn't taken apart a human brain before, but if you have ever had the opportunity or an animal brain, you'll realize that they're very soft. It's very soft and squidgy, right? And so a lot of the delivery devices that have been developed have been hydrogels. And a hydrogel, put simply, is basically like a jelly, just like jelly on the plate, or in America, Americans, I think, are called jello, I'm not sure. And so it's like this soft substance. But the problem with jelly, for example, is it is very soft. We can make it match the human brain in terms of its properties, so it's well accepted in the brain, but it will dehydrate. If you leave jelly in the sun, it'll shrink down to a sort of a flat, sticky mess. And if you put water on it again, it won't rehydrate back to the same shape that it originally was made. All right. So they're also quite difficult to inject if they're ones that form once they've been injected into the brain, because they rely on temperature and things like this. And definitely people have got better and better at it. But it's that sort of route there using hydrogels is susceptible to the things that you need. You know, the surgeon would need to be trained in it very well, understand the material and things like that. But the work that we're doing with the cryogels, which are basically, I didn't really explain where the term cryogel comes from, but it's basically a hydrogel that you make and you put it together inside a freezer. Okay, so the cryo comes from the word ice, from Greek. Okay, so the ice crystals form within that jelly mix, basically in the freezer. And that means that you get these big pores, these big holes all the way throughout it where the ice crystals were. They're pure water, more pure ice. Okay, and so around them, the polymer network forms. That means when you defrost it, you get left with these big pores and things like that. So just like a sponge, on the outside feeling in, if you put it into the brain, what the brain feels macroscopically is a very soft substance. Yeah, all of those lines and the bits that are holding the sponge together, all of the network around that, what we call the struts, are very robust. So they can be picked up with a pair of tweezers, they can be moved about, they can be dried, just like a normal sponge, and then they can be re-wet with the drug, okay? So it means we can sterilize them and things like that. So it makes it, looking forward to clinical use, makes them very easy to use and very practical in that aspect. And it's not, the reason I get excited is because there's not really many materials out there which are so, you know, can be tuned to be so soft, yet it's remarkable that you can pick them up with a sharp pair of tweezers and they're not falling into bits, if you see what I mean. So that's where that dual characteristics of soft yet robust is what I find interesting. And of course, we can change the chemistry to help suit slow drug release and things like that. So I've actually forgotten where your question started off, but I hope that gives you an idea there. So.
I honestly, that's terrific. It was exactly what we wanted to hear. So you kind of described the characteristics of this, you know, a sponge-like gel, and why I do get is that it kind of compresses and reshapes to take in, you know, the shape that we want, which makes it really easy to inject. And what about compatibility? So we're not putting this into some, you know, science project model or anything. We're injecting this into a human being with a very dreadful disease. So how do you make sure that it is safe to do so, and has it been proven before?
Really great question. So first of all, I do want to say that we're very much down on the basic science end of the spectrum, right? So we are looking forward constantly in our design process to say what would be suitable for an end user, right? And I, a surgeon, and going into a human brain. But right now, our work is right at the very early stages of this, right? Because it's a new field for us going forward. But what we have done, so the way you would, you know, the way you would find those questions out of it, is it safe, is of course you don't go straight into a human. You take this first cells, you know, give it to cells in a dish and see how the cells respond to that. It's called in vitro experiments. And then you would typically go to in vivo experiments where you could place them in the brain of an animal and then sacrifice them later to see what the response has been to that. But one aspect of our work that's on a completely different note is our collaborators in Edinburgh, that led by Professor Anna Williams, who's an expert in multiple sclerosis research. They've basically do what's called ex vivo slice culture, where you can take a rodent brain, for example, a rat brain. Our collaborators have basically culture tissue slices or brain tissue slices in a dish, and that means that from one animal we can get multiple brain slices, and then we can place our materials on and see what the host response to that is. Is it biocompatible, is it not, etc., etc. And so work with Edinburgh, and also work with another collaborator who's working on human fetal tissue from explants in London, in King's College London. She's Dr. Catherine Long. She has really been helpful for us in answering that question. Are they safe? Are they not? And it turns out that, I mean, we knew we were building them from a very inert polymer, polyethylene glycol. It's pretty well accepted by the body, but you know, it's still, until you do the studies, you don't really know what's going on. And what we found is if we change the chemistry very slightly, we could make it so that the scaffolds were completely, or these cryogels, let's call them sponges, were completely well tolerated by the tissue. And so that was shown in Edinburgh to be the case. There they were placed next to the tissue. In London they were placed on the tissue, and it was found to have no adverse host response. So then, in terms of in vivo studies, the Edinburgh group has gone on to deliver different reagents to the brain, all in their multiple sclerosis theme of research, and shown to have no adverse side effects from the cryogel. So we've got early indications that they're good materials and they're well biocompatible, but obviously that needs a lot of validation work as we move forward.
All right. So I guess the more you know, the better. So obviously, the cryogel microcarriers have been applied to several other areas of research, which is quite nice. But in terms of practicalities, you know, what do these cryogel microcarriers actually have greater therapeutic potential, you know, in comparison to systematic drug administration? Because, I mean, that is kind of the golden standard in a sense when it comes to brain cancer. So would you be able to explain this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, firstly, as I alluded to, there's this problem of the blood-brain barrier. So currently, you know, the standard of care is to give a drug called temozolomide. Now, if you grow cancer cells in a dish and you give them temozolomide, they're not overly harmed by it. I mean, they are. It depends on the dose. Everything's, you know, it always comes down to sort of dose responses and things like that. But if you give them, there's a wide variety of other chemotherapeutics that you can give them that absolutely hammer them. They're really, really potent and will really destroy both the cancer stem cells, the glioblastoma stem cell population, and the rest of the tumor, right? We know they're much more potent than temozolomide, but temozolomide is used because it's one of the few that does actually pass the blood-brain barrier. So coming back to answering your question, you know, could local intervention via the microcarriers be, you know, better than systemic administration? Well, the answer lies in the fact that you could now target multiple mechanisms by which the cancer cells survive, by which they migrate into the rest of the brain. Okay, they actually switch between the type of cell they are. They're incredibly clever. They can switch from looking like a neuron to going back into a mode where they will rapidly divide, etc. So I think by this strategy, it gives us the opportunity to dose multiple drugs at once, also use drugs that can't pass the blood-brain barrier. And lastly, but really importantly, is you can give a relatively high dose to the tumor without it affecting all your peripheral organs. So there's this problem, obviously, with chemotherapeutics, as we know about in breast cancer, with hair falling out and everything else, is that the side effects limits how much dose you can give to the tumor, because the person's obviously going to become too sick. So if you can deliver them directly to the site, you can deliver a high payload without it affecting your liver, your kidneys, everything else, right? So I think those are the advantages of it. And I'm really excited by the prospect that, I think this could have a real step change in how we treat brain cancers and other cancers too, for that matter, with local therapeutics. But there's a long way to go in terms of developing, getting that release right. If you just release all the drug in the first day, for example, that might be great for certain aspects of it. But if you're really trying to encompass all the different ways that a brain cancer cell can survive, I think we need to have a slow release over a long period of time that can target this in multiple different ways. And that's not an easy part. To get that release right is the focus of my two of my PhD students at the moment in the lab. That's really what they're doing, is tailoring these to give longer and better and flatter release profiles. So it's not all just a big burst at the beginning and then all over.
All right. So I think we really focused a lot on the promising potential of these cryogels. And you mentioned one limitation, which is, how is it that we could systematically deliver the drug and not slowly release the drug, in a sense? Are there any other potential barriers to, using this commercially?
Yeah, lots, a huge amount. And this is what we call the sort of the translational pathway, or, the whole idea of scaling this up to becoming useful in a human. And this is something that I have no experience in. I've been reading a lot and attending various workshops and talking with the translational team at Cardiff. And it's something that's really annoying, because you think you get something that can work, and let's push this forward, let's go. So firstly, money. People wonder why the COVID vaccine became approved so fast. Tons of money facilitated them to be able to take risks, connect up clinical trials, all these sort of things, right? So funding in order to be able to do this is key, right? That's the main limitation that I think I will probably face, right? But along that line is, these are new materials, so they're not FDA approved for other uses. So that's the Food and Drug Administration in the US, and we have the European Medicines Agency here in Europe. But so they're not regulatory approved, should we say. And so that's got to go through that process of that. And so at any point along that way, things that could look promising can fail in terms of safety, something that we haven't forecasted, for example. Or in that, what typically happens is, things will work very well in an animal, and these are studies that we've got planned before Christmas now to test the efficacy of these in animal models, but that doesn't translate to being good in a human. And some really clear, obvious things, that's obvious to anyone that stops and thinks about it, is that the rodent brain is very small and the human brain is very large. And some of these glioblastoma resections can be really large indeed, like a golf ball size, right? And that's clearly way bigger than the models that we use in animals. So there's lots of hurdles along the way that we've got to pass through, and that's something that I think we've really got to think about, and something that I worry about here in the UK is the US seems to be very just look at their turnover rate of new inventions. It's crazy, right, compared to Britain. And we seem quite risk averse, and the money that's going to be needed, etc. I understand we've got to prove it at each way, but you've also, as an academic, got this pressure to publish as well as you go through. It's unfair if we get this working, and my PhD student works on this for 3 years, and he's not allowed to show anything for it at the end and try and get a job at the end. So this is also this pressure to publish on the way, but you can only do that once you've fully secured your patents on it and things like that. So there's all these, there's this whole world that's gonna, if these studies work and show it that it's really a useful strategy with these microcarriers. I think there's going to be a whole new world that opens up to me that's going to be long and difficult, but I think needs to be done if we're going to make a difference in patients' lives.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, doctor, the work you're doing is really challenging, and I highly admire the fact that you went for it when so many scientists tend to avoid this avenue because it's very underfunded, and the commercial sector kind of neglects it in a sense. What do you think? Okay, so focusing on translational work, what role does it play in addressing the challenges we face in cancer research?
Well, I think. Without translation to the clinic, you know, this. So I'm starting to see two separate sections of work. So some of the work that we've done in MS, for example, is allowed those researchers in Edinburgh to understand the mechanism by which MS it works, basically, or the effects of MS, right? And so I think there's the understanding basic biology, which is free and open to publishing. Off you go, you know, get a new finding, publish that, and then researchers can use that knowledge to develop therapeutics, right? And I see that as very much the, you know, super critical to be well funded and the basic science end of things, or blue skies research, or however you want to call it. That we're just finding out things about how our brain works, and how disease happens, etc., etc. But then the translational part of it is obviously really, really key to get right. And I think that, you know, the UK knows this. There's a lot of funding initiatives now that are coming in that are based around, you know, that we really want to see a product out of this. So which ones are promising, etc., etc. And so, yeah, really the translation aspect of it is really key. And I think really teaming people up with the full. The full amount of people that are needed, as in I need to be talking with end users, surgeons. Would you be happy to use this? Companies, you know, would you invest in this, etc., etc. Because without, you know, and then regulation at the same time, there's all these different aspects that need to come together in order to make this work. So that's why I feel very bad at the beginning, where I slaked the Gliadel wafer as not being particularly great. Those guys did something that wasn't done before, and they got it out there, and they got it working. It doesn't work particularly well and things like that, but that's a real big milestone that I've never achieved. So I think without that forward planning, just publishing papers on the material itself and the delivery and things like that will never result in it actually changing patients' lives. It's kicking the can down the road in terms of someone else has then got to make an even newer inventive step in order to be able to patent it. So actually publishing the paper can be damaging in terms of the translation of that research, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that makes a lot of sense, and I really admire the fact that you did spill out the ugly truth. That is exactly what is happening, and the beauty of translational work is that, you know, it kind of encourages multidisciplinary kind of collaborations, and that's what's going to lead it to move forward and for us to be able to find innovative, you know, solutions to these challenges that we're facing. You know, doctor, on an end note, where do you hope to see your future going, so your research going in the future, so within 5 years?
5 years, okay. That's interesting, because I want to tell you a little bit about what getting to here, really, and that when I was doing my PhD, I saw a lot of groups that just, you know, took government funding, they, you know, played about, they made some new materials and they published them, and that was the whole process seemed to be improving the PICV, and that allowed to get more grants and things like that, and I really wanted to be able to say that I've made an impact within 10 years, or I'm getting out of here, right? I don't want to just keep taking government money. And it's a little bit embarrassing looking back on that, because I guess my 10 years is running out pretty soon, right? From when I said that, next year, in fact. But on the plus side, the spillover effects of trying to aim for a therapeutic delivery system means that actually now I have many, a lot of groups now around the world that are using these materials for different applications and understanding basic biology. So I've kind of, I guess you just change the goalpost when you get there, don't you? But I've kind of allowed myself to think that I'm doing all right by providing these other clever researchers and these other great neuroscientists around the world use these materials for their research, and they're asking for more and saying, can you modify it to do this? Can it do that? This is great. We're now growing cells on these. We can understand the interaction between neurons and astrocytes and things like that that wouldn't have come about because of that. So for the next 5 years, I think we need to gain concrete data on whether this really holds promise in animal models. But I think for glioblastoma work, should I say, so on the glioblastoma side, does it work or does it not? We need to think a little bit differently about the way we interpret animal model data. There's a lot of, we conducted a systematic rapid review, or systematic review, should I say, and meta-analyses recently of all the other people's work in this field. And there are a lot of studies that suggest, these sort of local interventions can work. They can cure the animal model and off you go. But curing the model is not actually as important as understanding where does a drug go, how long does it last, how deep does it penetrate the tissue. I think these are all things that can then be related to the human problem rather than just did the animal survive or not, okay? Because we know brain cancers are far more complicated than our models are. So definitely, I'm hoping over the next couple of years to get good data on that. I hope that my materials can continue to be used by other labs to find out interesting basic biology. And so, coming back to Parkinson's as well, I've got a project idea on the go for how we can improve the survival of cells post-transplantation to the brain. And I'm dead keen to get that started and going and really have a look at that in depth. But that's going to need recruiting new members to my team, building up a bigger lab. I need to get more students and postdocs in. And the ultimate driver of all that is funding. I've got to get better at grant writing, as we all do in research.
Oh, wow. I really look up to you, and I believe a lot of the students that are listening to this are thinking the same. It's amazing. You just mentioned a 10-year benchmark. So 10 years in how many months?
I think it was 2003, I guess. I finished my PhD. It must have been April, I think it was.
Oh, wow.
The only reason I know it well is often grants, would have a within 2 years of your PhD or within 5 or 7 years. So I'm now, I guess, no longer, I always think of myself as a student and pretty much still, I feel like an early career. I guess time's passing and I'm getting a bit more wrinkly, and I'm not no longer an early career researcher, I suppose. But I guess the fruits of my labor have really come out by collaboration. Going to neuroscience conferences, going to transplantation conferences, and chatting with people, and the best collaborations come when they say, "I really need to be able to do this. Could your material do that, please?" And if the answer is yes, then that's really great. It's not like a forced thing where, "Oh, please, can you use it to show this for me for that?" It's where they've got a real need, and I can supply something that doesn't exist on the market, and they're happy with it. And so, potentially in 5 years, another thing I've been toying with is could I commercialize these for research purposes only? Okay, so researchers can use them as a tool for their neuroscience applications, and that's something that I'm thinking about. And there are far fewer barriers to commercialization because there's no regulatory approval, or very little, should I say, to go through with that. So that might also be a good avenue to take my research.
Okay. Yeah, I think the way you're thinking about it makes a lot of sense, because If I was to speak of like my experience, I'm very new. I've only had experience with collagen hydrogels, and let's just say they're not the nicest thing.
Funny enough, just to interrupt you, my PhD was using collagen hydrogels.
Oh, look at that!
When I was trying to say some of the problems about, you know, premature gelation and things like that, where they gel too quickly at the wrong temperature, go on. I shouldn't interrupt you, but go on. Yeah.
No, not at all. But I agree with everything you mentioned about they're quite sensitive, and you know when you're using modes of drug delivery, they're supposed to serve you and not kind of tackle your work and you know, make it more complicated. So I think what you're doing is truly amazing, and the fact that you're willing to share it with everyone in your field, it's quite rare nowadays. I'm just saying.
They're really trying to focus on simple chemistries that make them reproducible. A lot of the work I did during my postdoc, my wife, Heike, was where she wasn't my wife then, but we were working together, and she was working away on a different type of cryogels that were made from made with heparin, basically from porcine heparin, and just the batch to batch variability. For some reason, they would work in winter and not in summer, or vice versa. I can't remember which way around. But you know, whereas I wanted something that was super reproducible for making. Means that they're always exactly the same each time we're making them. That's why they're fully synthetic, and so we now mimic the properties of heparin in our materials for slow releasing of proteins and things like that. Wanted them to be easy to make and easy to use, and so because of that, they're actually quite basic. They're not going to win a prize for, you know, the best fancy diagram of this bit coming off and then that bit joining on and those sort of things. It's really quite basic chemistry. But it's reproducible, and hopefully, like you said, it should be easy for the end user to use.
Definitely. I mean, speaking of chemistry, there's this very lame chemist joke, and it's like, it goes like, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the precipitate. So it's like, so yeah, you might not win a Nobel Prize, but you're doing terrific work, and you're contributing a lot, and for that, we're very grateful. Thank you. Thank you. And can we ask, we're taking way too much of your time, but I might as well ask. So we've got a lot of, you know, early career researchers here, and we would just like to know, what advice would you give, you know, a researcher at the early stages of their career, and what advice do you think they should ignore specifically?
Okay, I mean, it's one of those things, good question. It's really nice to look back on and think what bits worked well for me and what didn't go so well and things like that. And I'm actually thinking of trying to make some sort of small YouTube video on this, because I think it's something that I really benefited from in my PhD was a concept called slow motion multitasking, and I'm really sorry, I forgot. I'm sure it was in a TED lecture that I saw it, but I didn't know I was doing it until afterwards, and that's the phrase for it, where you basically you think of yourself as in a lab where you've got all these you've got all this amazing equipment, and your supervisor doesn't really know what you do on a day-to-day level, so have a bit of freedom to go off on a side project and make sure that this, I mean, like you with your podcast, right? You really enjoy making this, and when you go off on a side project, you feel the ownership of that, and you start to enjoy it probably more than your main project. Now, I have students in the lab, and I don't want them particularly wasting time going off and doing something else, right? But it's better to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission, right? Go off, and if you think you've developed, you know, your research that you're doing. I don't know, but maybe I want to go and have a look at these receptors instead or something like that. As long as it's not taking too much of your time, of your main time, I reckon those side projects have been really useful for me in many ways, and certainly the ability to publish with them. So if you, for example, I built a gene vector, so that's basically an artificial virus while I was doing my PhD, and You know, we showed it worked and a load of other stuff. But then, but in the background, sort of secretly, I've been trying them on a totally different subsection of cells, on neural cells, because I was interested in the brain and things like that. And you know, my supervisor, you know, I'm sure he's fine with it now, but they didn't really know, didn't really question. I sort of presented it sort of as a finished, nearly finished article, and here you go, how about this? And I think that allowed me to publish a lot more during my PhD than if I'd just gone down one route. And that's not to say go behind your supervisor's back, that's horrible, isn't it? I sound terrible, but do something that you're interested in as well. Make use of the great lab, if you're in a great lab, hopefully, that you've got. And I think the other thing, the obvious plus of that, is not putting all your eggs in one basket. There's a lot of PhDs, you know, one of my students, you know, and he's just finishing his PhD, and, you know, poor guy has been trying to release glucose for 3 years, and glucose is a really difficult molecule to try and release slowly. And, you know, he did some side projects and some other little things, and that's really great for him. It's made his PhD better. It's made his employability afterwards better with these papers that will come out from it. And yeah, I think it's, have a go, and you might know more than your supervisor as well, who probably do. So feel free to explore those areas and have some fun with it.
Oh wow! I think the idea of kind of investing in side projects is not something you hear every day. Usually, you're told to have focal attention onto your project and just like. You've gone against the odds.
Maybe that's right. They definitely don't scatter too far. I went through with my postdoc time. So in my PhD time, I did a lot of things that. You know, I chat with my old supervisor now, and I'm sure he's fully aware that we didn't always see eye to eye on everything, right? and I had some really great co-supervisors too, and it was just an interesting mix of having really good stuff. And what he did provide me with was a great learning environment and things like that. So I really took use of that and did these side projects. And then in my postdoc, I had a Wellcome Trust fellowship. So I was really lucky. I went off to Germany with that. And there I went to a really well-funded group headed by Professor Carsten Werner. And there I could kind of had no limitations. It was the best 4 years of my research. I'm dreaming about this, I'm going to make that, I'm going to do these things. Fantastic, really, really good.
Sky's the limit.
There it had gone too wide. I had to then start to think, right, I've got to cut this project because I'm going to have 10 projects that have started, nothing's going to finish. So definitely there is a flip side to going, you know, you've got to have a good aim and why you're doing it. And really, I guess, fairly early on, after I published my first paper, I realized the sort of format that they fit in, and you know, let's try and replicate that in a few other areas, I suppose. But yeah, I definitely went a bit off the charts during my postdoc and had to rein things in a bit. But I think now as I get older, I need to inject a bit more of that postdoc time back into things. I'm getting too concerned about, oh well, that won't work for this or that, instead of just going out and having a go and seeing. So I gotta try and get a bit more useful again.
No. I think a good balance, a really fine balance, is what you're kind of indicating and hinting to, is that do pursue further like side projects, but at the same time, know at the end of the day what truly matters and why is it that you're doing what you're doing. So
Definitely know why you're doing what you're doing. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it can be frustrating as a supervisor when, you know, someone's gone off and spent a month doing something, but you haven't really thought that through, have you? So there are two sides to the thing.
Oh well. Well, Dr. Newland, thank you so much for your time and for all the work you've been doing. Honestly, we really look up to you, and for all you listeners out there, please feel free to check out his academic profile, and feel free to reach out on Twitter as well, because I provided that in the show notes as mentioned earlier in the episode. Is there any last words you'd like to leave us with before we end this?
No, I don't really. Just to say thank you very much for having me.
Oh, anytime. You. It's a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for being here. And for all you listeners out there, please feel free to leave a review and subscribe wherever you listen to this podcast show. And thank you again for listening. And more importantly, thank you for your interest in science. Goodbye.